You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
You're listening to The Archaeology Show. TAS goes behind the headlines to bring you the real stories about archaeology and the history around us. Welcome to the podcast.
Hello and welcome to The Archaeology Show, episode 333.
Today we have a timelines episode where we take a look at what was happening in the world around 1450 CE.
Let's dig a little deeper and find out why none of these people knew each other. Welcome to the show, everybody.
Hello.
All right. So for you audiophiles out there, you may notice that Rachel doesn't sound very good because yes. She's not using a regular microphone.
I sound like any other guest on a podcast.
Well, but yeah, true.
I'm not at home with my regular microphone. So I am on, regular people recording equipment, i.e. AirPods.
Yeah, pretty much. No, yeah. Actually, her microphone broke, and we can't afford a new one unless we get 1,000 more members to our website.
Oh, my God.
So
that's like shameless lying right there.
If you're not a member of the APN.
That's actually untrue.
All right.
Don't listen to him at all.
ArcBunNet.com/members. Anyway, so.
But yeah.
So we have a timelines episode today. As we said, we're looking at the world around 1450 CE, and we've got three different societies in three very different parts of the world. I'll just tell you what they are. It's Angkor Wat in Cambodia, Machu Picchu in Peru, and Constantinople in Turkey. And you might be thinking, isn't that Istanbul? No, it's Constantinople, but we'll get to that.
Right. And you might also be thinking, like, wait a minute, these don't exactly all line up because Constantinople was earlier and Angkor Wat was earlier and stuff, but like, we are kind of refining what our idea of timelines is, and what we want it to be is not like three places that are thriving at the same time. It's like what is happening at this exact time in three different places. And that might be thriving. It might be on its way out. It might barely exist at all. So that's why these three places are in very different developmental points as well in around the year 1450. So that's why we picked these.
All right. I kind of like to think, too, I was thinking about this when I was refreshing my memory on the notes. 1450, there are people being born in what became the United States, North America, that will meet Europeans for the first time.
Oh, like, yeah, true.
They'll be older, but they'll meet Europeans for the first time, and that'll be crazy.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. Yeah, it is crazy because, like, America has not been discovered by Christopher Columbus yet. So, there's no European contact at all at this point. So we've got very separate sides of the world still at this point in 1450.
Right. Yeah. Indeed. All right. So let's head over to Cambodia and Angkor Wat.
Yeah.
All right.
So Angkor Wat was built in the early 12th century CE by King Suryavarman II. Oh, wow. That was terrible. You try it.
Suryavarman?
Suryavarman, Suryavarman II. And it is the world's largest religious monument. Really cool place. If you've never looked at pictures of it online, definitely should go take a quick peek. Look at we've got some links in the show notes, of course, but very unique and cool looking remains that we have today.
Yeah, I didn't actually know it was the world's largest religious monument. I guess it depends on how you define that, because Vatican is like Vatican City is, I guess, but that's not really a monument, I guess, to religion necessarily. But I guess it depends on how they define it.
Yeah, like this complex is bigger than all of the religious structures, I think, probably. But also, it's very subjective. So I'm sure you can argue for something else. But it's very large. Let's go with that.
Right. The temple was originally dedicated to the Hindu god Vishnu before becoming a Buddhist site. So it's gone through some modifications culturally and probably architecturally as well, because I would imagine anything related to Vishnu could have and probably was really removed. We actually know that for sure. So don't quote me on that. But that's often what happens when something is rededicated or rebranded, especially when you're talking religion. The signs of the old religion are removed and the signs of the new religion are installed. So just depends on how they kind of thought about that.
Yeah, and apparently the central quincunx of towers, which is not a word I had heard before, but I think it's because there's five major towers, so that's where that comes from. but they symbolize Mount Meru, the center of the universe in Hindu and Buddhist cosmology. So
Yeah. It's surrounded by a massive moat and high walls, which are both defensive and symbolic. The bas-reliefs on the temple wall depict epic scenes from the Ramayana and the Mahabharata.
Yeah, and Angkor Wat is just one part of the greater Angkor Archaeological Park, which includes Angkor Thom and Ta Prohm and Bayan. So it's really a huge area.
City of Angkor was the capital of the Khmer Empire, and it had up to 1 million people at its peak. So not a trivial amount of people going on here and a massive city to manage. So the size of the temple makes sense.
Mm-hmm. And the construction used sandstone blocks that were transported from quarries over 50 kilometers away. So they put a lot of manpower and effort into building this thing, of course.
Mm-hmm. I would imagine this took a really long time to build because it's probably one of those kinds of things where they're always just adding on here and there and a little bit. So, you know, obviously the first part of the temple was built during the Vishnu era, you know, when it was dedicated to Vishnu. But even after it was a Buddhist temple, I mean, I don't know when they stopped building on it, but probably not that long ago, if I had to guess.
Well, it stayed in use for a long time. And part of the reason why we picked it is because it was declining by the time we reached the year 1450. So this is a really good example of something that was, it was on the way out at that same time period that other places were rising. So, and it was reclaimed by the jungle at some point, and now it's a place that you can go and visit or whatever. But yeah, they did use it for a very long time.
Yeah, the site's orientation and layout are aligned with celestial events like equinoxes and solstices. And archaeologists have mapped an extensive network of canals, reservoirs, which they call barres, and roads, which are evidence of advanced urban planning.
Mm-hmm. The Bayan Temple is famous for its smiling faces, which are carved into the stone towers. And that's probably the picture that people have seen the most.
I don't know if I would. I mean, their mouths are curled up on the ends, but I don't know if I'd say they're smiling. They look kind of like they're hatching an evil plan.
But, right? Yeah, totally.
Ta Prohm is known for its jungle temple look with massive tree roots enveloping the ruins. I feel like this one has been in a lot of movies. And what was it? Oh, I cannot think of it. Well, anyway, it's either been depicted in movies or been actually used in movies. I'm not really sure what their philosophy is on having film crews come in.
Or like it's inspired the architecture that is created by, you know, cinematography things that I don't understand or know how to do. It does seem like it's an inspiration because it's just such a cool and interesting structure that has been repeated across time and place, you know?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, so we talked about how it was in decline around this time, and that may have been linked to climate change, water management failures, and invasions. So, because I was wondering, you know, you've got such a prominent temple in use for a really long period of time, what would cause people to not be able to use it anymore? Because certainly the Buddhist religion extended through, you know, through that area and is practiced today in that area. So I don't know if it's the primary religion anymore in Cambodia, but definitely is in practice. But water management failures would definitely cause a problem because if you don't have water, you can't live typically, right? So depending on how far you'd have to bring it in, that could be a problem. And then of course, invasions. If it was just the subject of, you know, many battles, then it would be difficult to maintain a presence there.
I'm not sure if there was actual like battles at this site exactly, but the Khmer Empire fell to the Ayutthayas in 1431, which is about 20 years before our target date of 1450. And when they fell to that invading empire, essentially, it just fell into decline and then eventually into ruin because this new group of people just didn't use it in the same way. And that's probably contributed to why it was declining by our year of 1450 at this time.
Yeah. Now, as it declined and fell into disuse, obviously the jungle doesn't wait and will just continue continuing on. Yeah.
Especially not this jungle. Like it moves fast and takes over quickly. Yeah.
I imagine gardening was a constant activity, you know, and by gardening, pruning and just keeping the jungle back. Yeah, but anyway, once they weren't doing that anymore, it was assumed pretty quickly, but the locals always knew something was there, right? They always knew it was there. Yeah. It wasn't a big deal. Somebody was always living there, even though it was in decline. Mm-hmm. But it was rediscovered by Western peoples with French explorer Henri Mout. I don't know how to pronounce that, but he's French. And he discovered it in the 19th century. Yeah. So it's so important that Angkor Wat actually appears on Cambodia's national flag as a symbol of heritage and pride, and is also a UNESCO World Heritage Site and attracts millions of visitors annually. So,
yeah, of course, it has a huge conservation effort focusing on both the architecture itself and the surrounding landscape. And you can really see that in the way the grounds are taken care of and the images and stuff that you can see of it today. It's definitely a place that I would love to visit at some point. But I don't know if it was on our like top 10 list of places to go, but after doing this research about it, I feel like it really should be, because it just seems like such an extraordinary place to visit for sure.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. Yeah. Archaeological work continues on the area with new discoveries being found about the urban sprawl and daily life of Angkor Wat, because, you know, like a lot of big sites like this, it's easy to see the big stuff, but we want to know how people lived. We want to know how it interfaced with surrounding community, right? The whole temple area. How was it part of the urban planning and things like that? So that's the kind of things the archaeological projects are finding. And they're also using LIDAR to reveal hidden temples and cityscapes beneath the jungle, because LIDAR is pretty good at finding stuff below vegetation because of the way that it penetrates, so to speak. And there's a lot of stuff around this that they just haven't cut the jungle back and found. So, but they're starting to find it.
Yeah, for sure. And the temples themselves are rich in inscriptions, which, as they translate and find more and uncover them, they're providing more information about the Khmer history, religion, and all the things that we didn't necessarily know about this group of people who were around for like centuries. Like this site in particular was in use for centuries. So this is a really important culture in this part of the world for sure. Very influential.
The art and architecture of Angkor Wat and this whole area around it influenced Southeast Asia for centuries. It was an incredibly important site and everybody knew it.
And makes sense.
Yeah, the sheer scale and beauty make it one of the world's most awe-inspiring archaeological wonders, which is why it's a UNESCO World Heritage Site and on their flag and everything. So anyway, that is Angkor Wat in Cambodia. Go see it if you can. And I would say most people have probably seen an image of Angkor Wat, even if they don't know what it's called, or if they couldn't tell you where it's at by hearing the name, because you've either heard the name or you've seen an image. And I would say our next one, which was starting to be constructed around this time, so one's fallen off and another one is coming up, is Machu Picchu in Peru. Yeah. I feel like so many people, at least on this side of the globe, know about Machu Picchu. Some people have been there. Images. Like, at least half of the people on this podcast have been there. and now we're going to talk about that. Yeah, we're going to talk about that on the other side of the break. Back in a minute. Welcome back to episode 333 of the Archaeology Show. I didn't realize it was all threes. It's got to be some significance there.
All right. No, I'm not it's into just numbers. A number.
Yeah, indeed. All right. So, Machu Picchu.
I have to tell you something.
Yeah.
Did you know that I have been to Machu Picchu?
What? Rachel saying she's been to Peru and Machu Picchu is like people who went to Harvard telling you they went to Harvard.
I mean, I love making fun of myself for it, though, because like I've been to a lot of places in this world at this point. But for some reason, I just really love talking about Peru. It was that like time in your life where like everything is so has such a big influence on you, you know? So young 20s thinking archaeology was like the best thing I have ever encountered in my life. And don't get me wrong, it's super cool. But like, sometimes I feel like I like talking about archaeology more than I like doing it. So here we are behind microphones. Makes sense.
Right.
Anyway.
So I'm curious. I mean, tell us, we got a bunch of notes here about like where it's located and things like that. But what was your experience about getting to Machu Picchu? How remote is it from the place where you were and maybe the nearest towns and cities? And then how did you actually get up there? Because there's a number of ways you can actually get up there, correct?
Yeah, totally. You can take a bus. I mean, you're coming from Lima, right? Lima is the capital, which is out on the coast or very close to the coast. And then, of course, this is up in the mountains. So you have to get up there. And it was a couple hours flight, not very long of a flight. Or if you're like me and you happen to be there when there's an airline strike going on in the early 2000s when I was doing this trip, we ended up having to take a bus. And that was a much more, let's go with harrowing experience, because you're careening around the crazy like mountain roads in a bus that just like does not care about how fast it's going around these curves. It knows how fast.
Yeah.
The drivers know how fast the bus can take a curve and they do it that fast. And anyway, So that was quite an experience taking a bus. I think I was able to take a flight there, and then I had to take a bus back because the airline strike started while I was there. But anyway, quite an experience. So you get to Cusco from sea level, basically. And Cusco is at 11,000 and some change feet, right? So yeah. It is crazy high. And so many people get altitude sickness. I know at least a couple of the people that I was traveling with weren't feeling super great the first day or two. So like you have to give your time to acclimate to that elevation before you can really like do anything. So I remember, like I was 20 years old, and I'm like breathing heavy walking around because like body's just not used to that elevation. And so from there you go to Machu Picchu, which actually is technically lower. It's at like 8,000 feet because you go down a mountain to get there. It's like in more of a valley. So, but Cusco is your access point. So you have to go up to that elevation in order to get to Machu Picchu. So yeah. And then once you're there, it's like a train, there's a train ride to, I think Agua Calientes is the name of the town. That's your true access point to Machu Picchu. And then you take a bus to the entrance. And then from there, you're, you know, hiking around these ruins at 8,000 feet. And it was just amazing because they don't really like stop. They didn't 25 years ago. They don't really stop you from walking around and experiencing it. You just can kind of wander around. There's certain places where you couldn't go, but I was there with other people. But at a certain point, we all just kind of scattered to do our own thing for a little while. And I was just like having that like transcendental, like, I can't believe I'm walking in this place that was built, you know, 600 years ago or whatever it was. It was really cool. It was really neat. And like you said in the beginning, all of that building was happening basically around 1450 CE. I think it was in the process of being built at that time, right? And the Incas had been around for a while. You know, they're on their way up at this point. So they have other structures around in the area that they've built. But Machu Picchu was specifically is, you know, in under construction at that time.
Yeah. And one of the reasons it's in, I mean, relatively decent shape compared to other, I would say similar type structures or settlements is because Spanish conquistadors never found it. You know, they weren't hiking up in the mountains. They came around by water.
The Spanish definitely got to Cusco because there's evidence of their structures there, but they didn't make it all the way to Machu Picchu from there. So
Which either means that by the time they got there, Machu Picchu either wasn't being used or just wasn't being talked about by the locals, because you would have had to have known where it was to go get it. It's not like you're just going to stumble on this thing and say, oh, look at it. Look what we found. Right. I mean, it's remote.
Well, and much like Cambodia, once it was not really in use anymore, because once the Incas fell to the Spanish conquistadors, of course, this wouldn't have been used anymore. Archaeologists believe it was a royal estate for Emperor Pachacuti. So once the Incas fell to the conquistadors, like, I just think it fell out of use, and probably the jungle, much like Cambodia, just sort of took it back pretty quickly. And even though locals knew it was there, probably talked about it to the Spanish conquistadors, they just never made it there, basically.
Yeah. Yeah. So the site itself includes over 150 buildings, which are temples, houses, storage rooms, and baths. And correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm imagining pictures of it because I don't have one up in front of me. But they're the kinds of rooms that you would typically see in an area like this, where they're all kind of interconnected, correct? It's not like a bunch of separate houses and things like that. I mean, there were probably separate buildings and areas, but there's a lot of wall sharing going on, right?
Yeah, a lot of wall sharing and a lot of terracing because it is in the side of a mountain.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, there was something called I don't know if you saw this, the Intihuatana stone, which is a carved ritual stone that actually likely functions as a solar clock or a calendar. Do you remember seeing something labeled that at the time?
I probably did. I did like your basic tour. Yeah. So I probably saw all of the main points, but I don't remember exactly.
Yeah.
And like, that was like, it wasn't pre-digital cameras when I went, but it was like right on the line when digital cameras were starting to be used. And like, I remember I have some photos from that time, but honestly, I don't even know what happened to most of them. So.
So there's a lot of sun worship in Inca society. And in fact, in a lot of South American and Central, even Mexican societies, right? The Temple of the Sun, which is there, features precision cut stonework and is aligned with the solstices. There's also the Sacred Plaza, which is surrounded by temples and elite residences, which shows how the city had a ceremonial core to it. It makes me wonder how often they actually went up there. If it was a residence, I wonder if it was like a summer residence, you know what I mean? because they probably got snow there at that altitude.
Oh, I'm sure they did. It's in the 80s, so I'm sure they were socked in with snow in the winter. I would imagine it as a summer residence, and the emperor would basically move his, you know, for lack of a better word, court to this place whenever he so chose to go visit there. So terraces cling to the mountainside, and they're used for agriculture and erosion control. If I remember correctly, it's a really sophisticated use of terracing, both for the food that they were growing and for the erosion control too, because that was really important with such a steep hillside that they were building these structures into.
Yeah. So the way that you didn't get there was via the Inca Trail.
Not the way that I went.
But it's a famous hiking route, and it ends at the Machu Picchu's Sun Gate. So I couldn't imagine, like, we like hiking to like a waterfall or something with something pretty at the end. And I just couldn't imagine like hiking up this Inca Trail. Yeah. I mean, I don't know where the trail actually, I don't know where people generally get on the trail. It's probably up a little higher.
From what I understand, it starts in Cusco and then goes up, well, I think up and then down and around. I don't know. It's a whole like thing that you can do, and you need a guide, and it's through like some pretty like complicated jungle to navigate if you're not a local. So I honestly like thought about doing that, but it would have added like weeks to my trip in Peru and a lot more planning and a lot more supplies than I was willing to do at that time. So I didn't do it, but you could do it in pieces too. I think today you can do like 1, 2, and 3 day versions of it rather than the whole big long thing. So
yeah,
I don't know. It seems kind of amazing to do that, but same trail they walk basically. Yeah.
Yeah, the city's water system is another one of those kind of amazing things about this. They had fountains, canals, and an aqueduct actually brought fresh water in from nearby springs. So it seems like it was uniquely positioned around the high mountainous areas. It wasn't super high. It wasn't like up on a ridge. It was down where they could have things, you know, flowing to it. So there was a lot of thought and planning into the location of this.
There really was. It's crazy. Like, there's actually another temple that's like, I did not go to it because I didn't have time in my visit, but like there's another temple that was higher up on a ridge further away that you could hike from Machu Picchu if you got there early enough in the day to do the hike there and back. And, or you run, like one of the guys I was with was like, I'm going to just run there and back. I can do it. And I was like, bye. Have fun. I'm not doing that. But yeah, like that was up higher for sure. So they were able to have the stuff coming down. They had that take advantage of gravity with that.
Yeah.
The Temple of Three Windows offers panoramic views and hints at the Inca cosmology. And then in archaeological digs, they've uncovered ceramics, tools, human remains, and other items and remains that give insight into what the sort of daily life would have been like here. But I feel like it can't be too much, though, because like this was built right around the time that we're talking about right now. And then the, you know, European Spanish conquistadors come like that much, not that much later, you know? So it didn't have a long time to really become an established city.
Yeah. The cool thing I like about this is, and a lot of Inca and Aztec construction, I know two separate continents, but I mean, there was a lot of similar construction techniques going on. They hadn't really invented the idea of mortar to hold rocks and things like that together and to keep things from falling apart. They just had really good stone fitting.
They were like, take your mortar and go away, Spanish conquistadors. We just, you know, carve our stones so they fit together perfectly as if they were one stone to begin with. It's amazing.
I feel like mortar allows you to make a lot of mistakes because it can be bumpy and unfinished, and you can just like slather it together with some mortar and call it good, right?
But constant maintenance. Like, you can't just leave it alone forever and ever. Like, you're constantly, you know, redoing the mortar. Not with this, though.
Yeah, it makes me wonder if there were some other, like, building stuff, something like this, like an emperor's residence or, you know, ceremonial places and things like that. Yeah, they had these masterful stonemasons, you know, putting this kind of stuff together. And then you go down to the, you know, average, you know, Joe Inca in his house. What does that look like? You know, is there, you know, are they using more crude construction techniques? I don't have the data on that, but it would make sense, but who knows?
I actually don't know. There's some evidence that Machu Picchu had astronomical and religious functions, not just residents. Of course, you know, if they move their entire group here, for the summer or whatever, mm-hmm. they're going to also have their religious stuff that they do on the daily basis as well. And then also here's in our notes, we've got the nearby sites include Hayana Picchu, a peak with additional ruins, and the Inca Bridge, which is a secret entrance. And that the Hayana Picchu is the one that I'm talking about. That's the one that the guy that I was with decided he was going to just like run to get there in time before we had to be back to our bus to get back to Cusco. So yeah.
What's up with the Inca Bridge? Did you see that? The secret entrance?
No, I didn't. And I'm not sure what that is. So I don't know if it was just like not a thing back then or what.
I think it's in a cave and you have to throw rocks out on it to see that. And it's an invisible bridge, I think. Or maybe that's Indiana Jones. I'm not sure. Maybe that's not exactly true.
Yeah.
Anyway.
I don't think that's a thing at all.
Yeah. Like most things, when this fell out of use, locals knew it was there. There's always somebody that knew it was there.
Of course.
Europe,
we need a shirt that says the locals know.
The locals always know.
The locals always know.
But anyway, it was rediscovered by Hiram Bingham in 1911. Now, Hiram Bingham is a relatively famous explorer. You could probably call him an archaeologist, I guess, and for 1911 definition of archaeologist. And he's pretty well known in historical circles for finding and doing lots of different things, Hiram Bingham was. So
yeah, for sure.
The site is surrounded by what they call a dense cloud forest. Yes. I don't know if that's just because it's so tall and it's in the clouds or what makes it a cloud. Okay.
No, that is. That's like the main reason because it's such high elevation, I'm pretty sure. Yeah.
Well, that elevation provides for some special things to live there. It's home to orchids, spectacled bears, and rare birds. Now, I saw spectacled bears in the literature that we were reading about this. And I was like, what does that mean? Bears that wear glasses? What's happening right now? But the spectacled bear, also known as the Andean bear, it has a few major claims to fame. Most notably, it's the only native bear species in all of South America. So that's it's from South America and it's the only one from there. They get their name from the ginger, cream, or white markings that encircle their eyes and run down their necks and their chest. And you got to look these things up because they have like a really kind of pointy snout. They're very... What do they look like? They almost look like a sloth,
I think.
They do.
Yeah, they're kind of weird looking.
Yeah, they're very strange looking.
It got almost like raccoon markings a little bit or something.
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah.
Yeah. So. Yeah, weird.
All right. In the year of Rachel's birth, Machu Picchu was designated a World Heritage Site.
Are we sharing that publicly with the world? Okay.
It was the early 1983s.
So, oh, okay. Got it. Thanks for saying that. Perfect.
No, and as with a lot of sites like this, ongoing conservation efforts are trying to balance tourism with preservation because they know that in order to get money to preserve it, they need to allow tourists in, but tourists are destructive by nature. So they've got to control where the tourists go without damaging the experience, right? It's like when we went to Chichen Itza, they don't allow people to climb on that anymore. It's just too dangerous and too damaging to it, which I was sad that we couldn't climb the temple, but also I get it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So
you want it to be preserved. Yeah. So like if that's what has to be done, then that's it. So Machu Picchu's was mysteriously abandoned. Like I said, I'm not sure it was that mysterious. It's probably partly the Spanish conquest. There's probably some disease going on, which was likely related to the Spanish conquest. And then resource depletion, too, probably would have been a problem, although they had amazing terracing going for agriculture purposes in Machu Picchu. But maybe there is another problem. Maybe they had a series of droughts or something like that made it so a place that they just couldn't live anymore. And but I think the Spanish conquest was sort of the main one that it fell out of use. So,
probably.
Yeah. And that would have been well after. So back to our sort of connecting time of or year of 1450. This would have been well after that, but not too long, you know, like 50 years, probably less than 100 years later.
Yeah. And Machu Picchu was part of a network of Inca sites, including Taitambo and Sacsayhuaman.
Sexy woman.
Yes.
Not sexy woman. Everybody says that.
Not sexy woman. Yes. Yeah. And artifacts found there show links to distant parts of the Inca Empire from the coast all the way to the Amazon. So it was a very important place that was visited and traded with. And it sounds like a lot of people probably knew about it during the height of its existence.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it was a really important place to the Incas. They put a lot of time, effort, manpower into building it and making it what it is. So, and today it's ruins, but it's really well-maintained ruins that are just amazing to see with your own eyeballs and Cusco too is such a cool city. So like, it's just a place that is kind of magical and worth the effort it takes to get there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. All right. Another place that is worth the effort to get there. And we spent a 24-hour layover there one time. That is Istanbul in Turkey. But we're talking about the fall of Constantinople. We'll talk about that on the other side of the break. Welcome back to episode 333. And we're on our third place that we're going to talk about. And that is Constantinople. Now, I don't know how many of you are familiar with the song by They Might Be Giants, but now I want to go listen to it. I think
everybody is familiar with that song.
I don't know about everybody. It's an older song. So anyway, the whole thing about the song is you have the city of Istanbul right now. It was Constantinople, but Constantinople was actually Byzantium. And in 330 CE, the Roman emperor of Constantine, not having any sort of modesty whatsoever, renamed the city of Byzantium Constantinople. So yeah, he's like, this is my city now, bitches.
Yeah, so. Totally. And you'll notice with this segment, we chose a place that has a way longer history. It goes way back, back way further than either of the two previous ones. And I thought that was super interesting because not only does this city reach all the way back to 330 CE, you know, 2000 years ago almost, but also it's still a thriving city today. Like, we're not talking about an archaeological site exactly right now. We're talking about a city that has been occupied from that time all the way up to today by different groups of people at different times. And if you go to visit it today, there are different places, and we'll talk about a couple of those that are preserved as archaeological, you know, remnants of the past. But yeah, it's still a thriving city today. So kind of cool when you think about it like that. Just like this city in 1450, you know, was going through a transition period, and but it made it.
Yeah.
It made it, right? Like, it's not ruined in a jungle. It's still there today. I just think that's so cool.
And if I'm not mistaken, I didn't look this up before we started recording, but if I'm not mistaken, the waterway that goes through the city, it might go through the edge of the city. I can't remember if the city's all completely on one side or not, but the waterway that goes through there splits the Asian continent and the European continent right there.
Oh, that does sound right. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I always thought that was kind of cool that you could just, I mean, of course you can drive from one continent to another. That's actually not too uncommon, but it's just neat that it's kind of like right there. And some people might do it every day. So
yeah, totally.
Anyway, in 395, Rome split the city between east and west, and the west fell less than a century later, and then Constantinople became the dominant surviving Roman capital in the east. So that was, you know, held by Rome. Well, and
Rome didn't split the city. Rome itself split into an eastern and western part of the empire. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And so, like, obviously, we know what happened in the west, but then this is the other piece of it. So, yeah.
Yeah. In the 500s, the reign of Emperor Justinian I built the Hagia Sophia, which is an incredibly popular temple, and developed the Justinian Code and other things like that. So he had a lot of influence on history at that time.
Yeah, like really very important things came out of that reign. And the Hagia Sophia is kind of what I was talking about in the beginning. Like, this is a place that is sort of a preserved example of, you know, really of archaeology, kind of, but it's like been preserved for ever and ever, you know, because it was built so long ago. And yeah, so it's a place you can still go see today. So by 1000 CE, Constantinople is a major Christian capital, which is another thing that I thought that was super interesting. This is a Christian capital at this time.
Yeah.
Which is really interesting given what comes next, but it's a major center of trade between Europe and Asia. But I guess being a more Orthodox Christian capital wasn't okay with the European Christians, because in 1204, European crusaders attacked the city relentlessly until they were finally able to take control of it in 1261 CE.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, isn't that interesting? Like, they were technically a Christian capital. Orthodox Christianity, which is different from European Christianity, but
in 1261, when they lost control, the Byzantines took it back but were severely weakened. For the next couple hundred years, they continued to decline as a society and an empire until the Ottomans invaded in 1453 and took the city themselves. And they're the ones who renamed it Istanbul. And that's where it is today.
Yeah. And we're hoping everybody will give us a little leeway with our dates here. I know it's 1453, not 1450. But like, we figured within like a 3-year range, like what's happening when one part of the world like versus another, we can still kind of compare those, right?
Well, yeah. And the thing is, you know, we're, when we talk timelines, we're talking about things that were, you know, there's various definitions that we have here. But the fact is, this has been a city for a couple of thousand years, right? And it's still a thriving city today, right? So it's never gone into decline to the point where it was ruined, right? Well, at least not in the last 1500 years anyway. So that's why I think having this be contemporaneous with Machu Picchu and Angkor Wat makes sense. Because you got, I mean, the thing I like to think about timelines is you got people just walking around a city over here going, I don't know what's going on anywhere else, but hey, you know, let's go have a sandwich, right? Like, they're just not even concerned with it. But people are, in the meantime, hiking up a trail every summer into the mountains of the Andes to, you know, establish their little society up there. And you've got people building, you know, and occupying a temple over in Angkor Wat. It's just so cool that these societies who think they're the center of the universe and they don't really know what's around them in general. The common man doesn't, right? And it's just, I don't know, it's really cool to me to think about these very different places being in existence at the same time, but still living their lives.
Yeah, exactly. That's what is so cool about this. And like, yes, these places had the ability to connect with each other, especially like a city like Constantinople being where it was between East and West was a great connection point between Asia and Europe. So, you know, maybe the people from Angkor Wat, there maybe there was some, you know, trade network or connection that happened between them. But then you've got Machu Picchu on the other side of the world, which was still very isolated at that time. That it had no contact with Europe or Asia yet. So, or at least not that we know of.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's just very interesting. The connections in the world between different countries in world politics today is so very interconnected, right? Like, everybody's meddling in everybody else's business all the freaking time, which is why we have half the problems that we do, it feels like sometimes. But these places were relatively isolated. And the way they rise and fall, I just think it's really interesting to look at these civilizations, the ones that last longer, the ones that are shorter, the ones like Constantinople that just transition names and become occupied by different groups of people, but maintain for such a long time and are still in existence today, compared with these other ones that sort of rise and fall in a more traditional way and become ruins that are now an archaeological site that you can go visit.
Yeah.
It's just so different to think about it like that, you know, like how it impacts us today too. And our experience of these cultures is so different too.
Yeah, for sure. All right. Well, that's it for today's episode. And I hope you enjoyed it. If you got any other suggestions for timelines, comparisons, we'll take them and then we'll drop them into an episode.
Yeah, for sure. Because we love, like, we're really going to try to focus on not just civilizations at their peak, like we've done in the past. We're going to just see like what's happening up, down, around, whatever's going on. So at this point right here, well, not at this point, because we don't have any explorers into North and South America yet, but I love in like 100 years, like the 1500s, 1600s, it's so interesting because you've got contact with North America. And so like you've got way different things happening in North and South America and then Europe and Africa and over in Asia, like very different things going on. So those time periods in particular are so interesting to me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. With that, thanks a lot for listening and we'll see you next week.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to The Archaeology Show. Feel free to comment and view the show notes on the website at www.arcpodnet.com. Find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at ArcPodNet. Music for this show is called I Wish You Would Look from the band Sea Hero. Again, thanks for listening and have an awesome day.
Thanks for listening to this podcast. The Archaeology Podcast Network's chief editor is Rachel Roden. Our executive producer is Ashley Airy. Our social media and newsletter coordinator is Matilda Siebrecht. The APN was founded by Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle on December 1st, 2014. We're supported by our amazing podcast hosts, many volunteers, and listeners like you. Check out membership at www.archpodnet.com/members.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.